Judgment and Justice, Reflection 6, Vineyard, Woe, and Invasion. Before we begin, I would like to say thank you to many who have sent in comments, positive feedback from around the world, expressions of gratitude, because putting together a series like this is a lot of work. I really appreciate your support and your feedback. In the previous lesson, we looked at a happy chapter. Well, yeah, there was fire in it, but it was a very short chapter, and it was the fire of purification, enabling God's people to have a new start, the ultimate vision. Now, as we move into Isaiah chapter 5, it's time to be sober again, as we find a number of oracles against Jerusalem. The chapter is in three sections. The first one is a parable, and then we find a series of woes, and finally a section on judgment. Beginning in verse 1. Let me sing for my beloved my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones, and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it, and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. This opening paragraph tells us of God's love. And yet, God's love is not reciprocated. The vineyard does not produce as it should have. Not grapes anyway, only wild grapes, or literally stinking things. One commentator suggests it should be translated stink fruit. And so there's disillusionment. God's looking for relationship. Instead, we have neglect. And of course, this parable is found also in the New Testament. Now, Jesus is the one who told the most parables and is rightly credited with the greatest skill in telling them. But we find parables in the Old Testament, not just the New. Also, you'll notice it says that he looked for it, the Lord looked for it to yield grapes. He waited, he looked for it. That phrase will come up three times in this chapter, and this will emphasize God's patience. God's not overreacting. Now, we go on to verse 3. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? Stink fruit. And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste, it shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall come up. I will also command the clouds, that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. He looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, an outcry. Well, that's the end of the parable. The parable of the vineyard reminds us of the significant time and skill that would be required to cultivate a piece of land like this. In Israel, if you've been, you know that nearly everywhere the ground is very rocky. There's stones everywhere. And so there's a lot of breaking up of the land that has to happen, hoeing. And then there's irrigation. Well, actually, even if you prepared the ground and irrigated, it wouldn't be enough. You'd have to protect the vineyard from animals. So a wall is put up around it. There's a watchtower, a guard tower, which the person tending the vineyard would be in to keep a watch for animals or for people who might destroy it. And then there's the work of digging out a vat in the stone and harvesting the grapes and trampling them and everything that's involved. This is time intensive. And God has done everything. He's set it up. He's set up Jerusalem and Judah for a win, but they've not taken advantage of those benefits. They've not reciprocated his concern. And he looked for the grapes. It says three times. That's in verses 2, 4, and 7. God is patient, and that patience is emphasized. It's also rather ominous when he says, I will remove the hedge, break down its wall, it'll be trampled. This seems to be an allusion, perhaps, to the coming invasion, to the time when the Assyrians will be going through Judah, and then ultimately the Babylonians will come and destroy Jerusalem in the 6th century. There are also a couple of word plays in verse 7. Let me read the English again. He looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, an outcry. Okay, that's the ESV. In the Hebrew, he looked for justice, mishpat, but behold, mishpach, bloodshed. Mishpat, justice, mishpach, bloodshed. For righteousness, tzedakah, but instead, a distress cry, tzedakah. So you have tzedakah, tzedakah. You can hear it when it's said out loud. And maybe that reminds us that all the Bible is an auditory experience. It's meant to be experienced aurally, that is, with our ears. And that's where a good commentary can be very helpful if you're reading it in a different language than the original. Well, that's the beginning of the chapter. There's the love song, which turns into a parable, the parable of the vineyard. And of course, when Jesus comes, and this is nearly 8 centuries later, 8 centuries after Isaiah's parable, that parable was all the truer. It rung even truer. Things were even more dire. In fact, Jesus says there's really just a generation or so before it's all going to be destroyed, which of course happens in the year 70 AD. All right, the middle section is on the woes. There are 7 woes. Let's go through them. Woe to those who join house to house, who add field to field until there is no more room. You are made to dwell alone in the midst of the land. The Lord of hosts has sworn in my hearing, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant, for 10 acres of vineyard shall yield but 1 bath, and a homer of seed shall yield but an ephah. Okay, let's take this apart. People are joining house to house, field to field. It says until there's no more room. It's well known that land speculation was booming in Isaiah's day. We know this also from his contemporaries, Micah and Amos, in Micah 2:2, Amos 2:6, and following. And so the rich are getting richer. And what's happening is the poor are getting squeezed out. For a really tragic example of this, we can see what was happening in the previous century with in the time of Ahab. Look in 1 Kings 21 and how Ahab and Jezebel managed to take the poor man's field. Well, I don't know if you would say he was poor, but he was more of a common man. Now, Naboth, they take his vineyard and have him executed. The poor are squeezed out. Of course, the Torah says that you're supposed to leave the edges of your land for the poor, because if there are crops growing there, they're to help themselves to whatever is at the edge or whatever may have fallen, the harvesters may have missed. We see this command in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy. So you have these rich people with more and more land. They're making a killing, literally here. And they've got these large and beautiful houses. And yet it says, without inhabitant. This is pointing to the time when judgment will be there, when they will dwell alone. That's interesting because we have opposite images. One is all these houses and fields squished up together. You think everyone is all in one place and, you know, socially, it's dense, it's packed, and yet they're made to dwell alone. There's this loneliness. Think about that. And the productivity that they hoped is not even there. 10 acres of vineyard shall yield 1 bath. Okay, we don't normally deal in baths and ephahs and homers anymore, but a bath is about 22 liters or 5 gallons. An ephah is a tenth of a bath. The idea is that your harvest is far smaller than even the seed that you sowed. Think of that. A homer of seed will yield but an ephah. Homer is 10 ephahs. Okay. So they want to be prosperous, but with all their greed, the land grab, they're not going to be prosperous. So this first woe is about property acquisition, you could say. And this will balance against the sixth woe, which is about money acquisition. Let's go on to the second woe. Woe to those who rise early in the morning, that they may run after strong drink, who tarry late into the evening as wine inflames them. They have lyre and harp, tambourine and flute, and wine at their feasts, but they do not regard the deeds of the Lord or see the work of his hands. Here, I think we're still talking about the upper class, the oppressors, and for them, it's all about the pursuit of pleasure, which they don't want to waste any time doing. They're up early in the morning, not to meditate on the works of the Lord, no, but simply to get their fix or to begin their long day of drinking. There's a section in the Proverbs, a woe to those who get drunk as well. At near the end of Proverbs 23, the reference, specific references in the notes that come with this talk. They drink from the morning until late in the evening, and they've got entertainment. There's music. And this is commented on also in some of the prophets. It's not that music is wrong. It's not even that drinking wine is wrong. But their culture is all about entertainment, recreation, diversion, stimulation, getting a buzz. And they don't simply care about the Lord or the work of his hands. They don't care about the poor. So drunkenness is frequently associated with the aristocracy. And there are other passages in Isaiah we'll read in this series and in the other prophets as well that emphasize this. And here we have self-indulgence. And that woe of self-indulgence matches pretty nicely the woe of self-importance, which we'll find in number five, that is the fifth woe. So the first seems to go with the sixth, the second with the fifth, and yes, the third goes with the fourth. But Isaiah has a few more words before we get to woe number three. Therefore, my people go into exile for lack of knowledge. Their honored men go hungry, and their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore, Sheol has enlarged its appetite and opened its mouth beyond measure. And the nobility of Jerusalem and her multitude will go down, her revelers and he who exults in her. Man is humbled, and each one is brought low, and the eyes of the haughty are brought low. But the Lord of hosts is exalted in justice, and the holy God shows himself holy in righteousness. Then shall the lambs graze as in their pasture, and nomads shall eat among the ruins of the rich. So the woe referred to the drinking, this kind of culture of pleasure seeking, not holiness. And the penalty is that they will go into exile. And being an honored person, being upper class, being rich, does not necessarily protect one. They all go into exile. And the grave will be full. Sheol is the underworld. In the New Testament, in Greek, it's called Hades. But Sheol is swallowing up the dead. Everyone's going down. And when a rich man dies, he's not rich anymore. We take nothing with us, right? He's humbled. Everyone's brought low. God is holy. And let me read that last verse I read again. Lambs then shall graze as in their pasture. Nomads shall eat among the ruins of the rich. So the people who live there, they're gone. And nomads are coming in and, you know, they're just pitching tent among the ruins of the rich. So this is quite ominous. Okay, now we're ready to look at the third woe. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of falsehood, who draw sin as with cart ropes, who say, let him be quick, let him speed his work that we may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near, let it come that we may know it. Well, this is maybe a more difficult woe to figure out. What does that mean, to draw iniquity with cords of falsehood? And he gives an analogy, sin as with cart ropes. Seems to be saying that people are attached to their sin as animals would be attached to a cart by ropes. But we're not supposed to be animals living at an animal level, a mere animal existence, doing what feels right, what's natural. We're to rise above that. But here, the people are not rising above it. Not only that, they think they can act with impunity. That they're pretty sure they're going to get away with everything they're doing without God ever knowing. So here we have sin pursued. In the fourth woe, sin justified. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. We notice the inversion. And this has a very modern ring, doesn't it? Where everything has been turned upside down or inside out. But it's not modern. It's just human. We see the same dynamic in Romans chapter 1. You'll see a parallel also in Amos 6:12. Again, Isaiah was not the only prophet writing in the 8th century BC. There are others like Amos and Micah that we can look to as well. Well, the fifth woe. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and shrewd in their own sight. That's a short one. Here, right and wrong are reduced to mere personal opinion. I think the problem is made even worse in our day when, as someone put it, many people are educated beyond their intelligence, meaning that holding a college degree doesn't necessarily make one wise. Many people are dilettantes, and they just pick up a little bit from this book, a little bit from that website, a little bit here from something forwarded to them, and they think they're wise. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes, shrewd in their own sight. Of course, the entire book of Proverbs issues that same warning. Wisdom in their eyes is not just wisdom about moral matters or about the rich and the poor. This would also include political wisdom. And this will come up in Isaiah 7 and in many other chapters. The prevailing wisdom is that you should make treaties, make alliances with a superpower, or at least your neighbor, with Egypt or Assyria. Political wisdom. But making treaties, trusting other nations to protect you, or even trusting in your own military, the chariots and horses, which we read about before, that's not the way of God. God is fully able to protect his people. And of course, we're referring to his Old Testament people. It's different now in these New Testament days. Now the sixth woe. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine, and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who acquit the guilty for a bribe and deprive the innocent of his right. It's not so much a passage against alcohol as against injustice. Drink affects judgment. Right? So these heroes, they drink wine. In fact, they drink strong drinks as well. But then that's connected with the bribery and the unjust treatment of the poor, of the innocent. As one Old Testament scholar put it, the sixth woe turns to corruption in the law court. The judges are weak-minded, undisciplined creatures whose strengths and virtues go no further than holding their liquor and mixing cocktails. In situations where real strength of character is needed to refuse bribes or defend human rights, they are miserable and culpable failures. I thought that was really well put. Well, I said there were seven woes. We only looked at six. Well, that's because the seventh one is delayed until chapter 10. So we'll leave it off there. It's time to get into the final section of Isaiah 5. Now, between the song, as another Old Testament scholar puts it, the song in chapters 1 to 7, and the darkness we'll read about in verse 30, Isaiah spells out the grim reality of the inedible grapes, verses 8 to 25, in six woes. It's not the Lord's way to pass and execute judgment without inquiring into the facts, nor to spring judgment on those who deserve it without alerting them to its cause. God is fair. Again, we have three sections. We have the song, you know, the parable, and then we have the woes, and we have the darkness. And those woes are important because otherwise, section 3, the judgment, the invasion, might seem extreme. But looking at the actual situation, the heart of the people, and particularly those in positions of influence, we see that God is justified. So let's read about this invasion. Therefore, as the tongue of fire devours the stubble, and as dry grass sinks down in the flame, so their root will be as rottenness, and their blossom go up like dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts, and have despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Here we see God's people are not in a right relationship with him. By rejecting the law, they despised him, and there's no excuse for rejecting the Torah. Continuing, therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against his people, and he stretched out his hand against them and struck them, and the mountains quaked, and their corpses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger is not turned away, his hand is stretched out still. So we have here an image of the mountain shaking, of corpses in the streets. This will be a result of the invasion. And we have in the invasion the removal of the watchtower, the hedge, the wall, the protection around the vineyard. God removes. It's not so much that God sends the Assyrians, though he does indirectly, but he takes away the hedge around Israel, the protection that they would have had if they had just trusted him, thus allowing the enemy to come in. I hope that makes sense. And now we read about the invasion. He will raise a signal for nations far away and whistle for them from the ends of the earth. And behold, quickly, speedily they come. None is weary, none stumbles, none slumbers or sleeps. Not a waistband is loose, not a sandal strap is broken. Their arrows are sharp, all their bows bent. Their horses' hoofs seem like flint and their wheels like the whirlwind. This is terrifying language of the approaching army who are disciplined, totally prepared. We find similar language in Nahum and also in the prophet Habakkuk. For example, look at Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 5 to 11. So this image would have brought terror. But we can see here that the Lord is using the Gentiles to chasten the Jews. He's bringing in a foreign nation. The Hebrew says nations, but this is the way he disciplines his people in the Old Testament, through invasion, through war, through exile. And God is sovereign over the events of the world. He's able to use those events for his purposes. And the result is terror. There's really no escape. And just to cement that truth, to remove all doubt, listen to the final three images in the last two verses of this chapter. Their roaring, referring to the armies, the enemy armies, their roaring is like a lion. Like young lions that roar, they growl and seize their prey and carry it off, and none can rescue. They will growl over it on that day like the growling of the sea. And if one looks to the land, behold, darkness and distress, and the light is darkened by its clouds. So we have the image of the lion, which would have been well appreciated in Isaiah's day. There were still lots of lions in Israel then. And then we have the growling of the sea, which, of course, ties in also to the image of the lion, the growling of the lion. And the sea is frightening in the Old Testament. I did a little piece on the significance of the sea from Genesis to Revelation. It has a symbolic meaning. And then the third image is darkness. So it's darkness and distress, the light being darkened by its clouds. Think of the plague of darkness that came against Egypt in the book of Exodus. There's no escape. The army, the lion, the roaring sea, the darkness. As one scholar put it, looking back on these first five chapters of Isaiah, Isaiah has now established the backdrop against which he worked as a prophet. The people to whom he was sent were the heirs of great promises, but appear to have forfeited them. By the end of his prefatory chapters, darkness has closed in upon them. Grace has been exhausted. Nothing but judgment lies ahead. And what does this mean for us? Well, let's talk about character. We are to resist the world. and its rationalizations. If we are in positions of leadership or influence, let's take heed of the warnings in Isaiah 5. In terms of social justice, the rich ought to take stock of where the riches have actually come from, how they've been obtained. Not all the wealthy are guilty of wrongs against the poor, but many are. And for many more, the wealth they've acquired or inherited was originally obtained immorally. Let's all remember, anyway, that we brought nothing into the world and will take nothing with us when we depart. And in terms of the pandemic, well, look, whether the world ends by a nuclear holocaust, asteroid collision, or a global plague, it will most certainly come to an end. The Bible assures us. Let's live wisely and soberly in light of that reality. In our next reflection, we'll look at the call of the prophet Isaiah in a lesson I've entitled simply, "Here Am I, Send Me."